STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hi there, folks. This is STR Ask, hashtag STR Ask, because that's the name of the podcast and where you send us your questions. I'm Melinda the Enforcer with Greg Kokel.
Hello. Hi.
That's it? Just one word?
I just can't win here, you know? I know. Say, howdy, hi. Hey, what's happening?
You get irritated when you get all crazy.
Okay, yeah, right. Hi.
Just maybe it's somewhere me. In between, not the extremes.
All right.
You know, not
hello, Melinda.
Dancing and doing air guitar and picking your nose. And pretending to. Oh, don't look like that. You know you've done that to try to make me laugh. And I hated myself for laughing. But anyways, here we are on hashtag STR Ask, the short podcast with short answers. And Greg is on a timer. You ready to go?
Wait a minute. Let me get my finger out of my nose.
Shut up. Okay, sorry.
All right, I'm ready. Rock and roll.
Okay. This comes from T Panda. What in Christianity is worth dying for?
All right. Well, top down, our confession about God and Jesus. There was some discussion a couple of years ago, I think, now, where some
journalists. It was like 15 years ago because it was during the Iraq War. Yeah, I know. Time.
No, it wasn't that long ago.
Yes,
well,
let's
okay. Whenever it was, there were journalists who were captured by Muslims and told to renounce Christ or something like that, and they did. And because they renounced Christ, their lives were spared. And there was some discussion about whether that was the right thing for them to do or not. And I remember
We don't even know if those guys were Christians.
Well, we don't even know that, but I do know there are other talk show hosts that said, "Hey, it doesn't matter, you know." Well, the point was that obviously this is a renouncement under duress, and therefore, just like a confession under duress, it doesn't count. And no one's going to believe that you are really renouncing Christ or God or whatever. And I just simply disagree with that. And I'm recalling now fairly recently, within a year or so, there were 20 Christians who were beheaded on a beach somewhere in the Middle East.
Libyan Christian, right.
Yes. And all they had to do was renounce Christ and their lives will be saved. And we had some, Alan in particular, when he was working in the Middle East last summer, had some indirect contact with these people. And the report back was that Christians went to try to comfort them in the loss of their loved ones. And it was really quite the reverse. Those that went to visit them were encouraged by these relatives of the martyrs, whose attitude was, we're praying to ask God to rescue them from the circumstance. But when it became clear that the only way that they would be rescued is if they would renounce Christ, they were praying that they would stay faithful. Mm-hmm. And they knew that when they were beheaded, it was because they remained faithful to Christ. And so this is something that is worth losing our life for. And by the way, if not that, what? Do we really want to say that, and maybe some will, I think, that there's nothing worth dying for? That is worth, some people will risk their life not expecting they will die, but no, it's a possibility. People go to war or run into a burning building or things like that. In this case, though, they know they will die if they do not recant. And the question now is if that isn't enough justification for giving your life, then what is worth dying for? What else is worth? What higher than God? And it strikes me that when you say not that, not even that, that our lives then become the most important thing in the universe. And I just think that's the wrong attitude. So certainly that. Then the question becomes now, I think, down the line, what kinds of doctrines would you risk dying for? And probably in history, there has been occasions when people were dying for doctrines. I know this happened with Christians. Mm-hmm. By other Christians,
I mean,
or other others in Christendom.
The reformers in England.
Certainly,
and Scotland,
you're in England.
The early reformers.
I'm thinking, who was the fellow there that was burned at the stake right there in Oxford? They've got a spot on the street where
Tyndale?
It happened. Not Tyndale. No. Tyndale was before him, but okay. He was one of that crowd. You know, there were a whole lot of people that were executed because of their work at distributing the Word of God to the average person, you know, and took it out of the hands of the laity, which at that time was the priests of the Catholic Church. But it wasn't just Catholics versus Protestants. There were, you know, we were talking at another time about being baptized again, and there were the Anabaptists who would teach that you should be baptized again if you believe in Christ as an adult, even though you've been baptized as a child. And boy, they got it from both directions. You know, the Anabaptists were brutalized by all kinds of Christians. So,
a lot of people may not realize that Martin Luther was hunted. There was a price put
that's
on his
right.
head,
that's
and
right.
he had to hide for many, many years. And mm-hmm. in fact, he got a lot of his work of translating the New Testament into German done while he was in hiding.
Right. Now, I wouldn't die for baptism, personally, but, and it's, you know, many Anabaptists were murdered because they believed that. That doesn't mean they chose to die for that, mm-hmm. you know. They were murdered as representatives of a group that some thought had heretical notions. I'm thinking of Martin Luther too. Yeah. And look at the people nowadays who are who have a price in their head because of the teaching against Islam and in favor of Jesus being the Son of God, you know. So I actually think the things that we ought to proclaim in the face, that we ought to hold on to and proclaim, even though it brings risk to us in certain environments, that list, it runs a little bit deeper than just, you know,
denying Christ,
quite a bit deeper probably, but, that doesn't, so I, you know, it's, I had another thought now, I lost it, but yeah, it does. And there are Christians now that are dying, putting their lives on the line for that, just as Martin Luther did for the gospel proper. What is the gospel? What is justification? And the idea that justification is by grace alone, through faith alone, through Christ alone, all of the solas, these were actionable offenses in their time.
Mm-hmm. The account that you gave us about the Libyan families praying for their family members to be released, but then praying that they will not renounce Christ. Mm-hmm. It just strikes me that they may—I mean, I obviously it was a very difficult thing for them to do, but it also it seems like it took little or no thought on their part, because I think some of these Christians living in these other parts of the world have to live with these possibilities much more than mm-hmm. we do in the West, mm-hmm. and so they've thought about some of these things, about what they'd be willing to die for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they decide in advance—
Right.
They know where their loyalties lie, and we have Christians in our country now, sadly, are waffling under the duress of name-calling.
Yeah, just peer pressure.
Yeah.
Next question comes from Floods 34. If miracles are, by definition, rare, would you not consider a conversion to Christ a miracle, since those are not rare?
Well, see, all of the answer to this turns on the definition of a miracle, okay? And I wouldn't say that miracles are by definition rare. What if look at the virgin birth, okay? That's a miracle. What is it that makes it a miracle? Is it that it's a miracle because it's unique and it hasn't happened before?
No.
Well, what if it happened to 10 people? Would it be any less a miracle if God did that with 10 people? I don't think that's a part of the definition. Plus, there's an excellent two-volume work out right now called Miracles by Craig Keener, K-E-E-N-E-R, that is really meant to make the opposite point. David Hume's famous argument against miracles in the 19th century was that, and that has taken hold of the intellectual crowd ever since then, is that you are not justified in believing something that is so unusual and rare, so to speak. So any testimony to something so bizarre is going to be so outside of the normal natural bounds of things that you will not be justified in believing it to be true. I kind of butchered that a little bit, but it's pretty close
it's
to that, you know.
It, yeah.
I mean, some Humeans are kind of cringing, but it's kind of like that. And what Craig Keener's trying to show is miracles aren't rare. Period. Here is the testimony after testimony after testimony. He goes into great detail. That's why they're two volumes, and they're thick. They're not pop This is not pop Christianity stuff. This is dense, and there are thousands, I almost said tens of thousands, but it could very well be over 10,000 footnotes in this. It's very, very well researched. And so it's a superb book, and I commend it to anyone who wants to claim that miracles are rare. I don't think they are rare. They are not commonplace, but that isn't like they happen every day to every person. But even if they did, again, depending on how you define miracle, which has got to be something kind of out of the ordinary and an act of God and some other things too, I still don't think that miracles being rare is going to be part of the definition.
Well, and even in the beginning of Jesus' ministry, it seems like, I mean, as many miracles as are mentioned in the Gospels, that there were a whole lot more because there were, you know, the word was getting around, and there were times he had to sort of tamp down the conversation and say, don't talk about this, because the word could get out, and they could come after him sooner than his time was ready.
That's right. In fact,
and he goes to his hometown early in his ministry after he's already done some miracles in Galilee, and they expect him to do miracles there because they've heard about all the other miracles that he's done other places. Right. So he was doing a lot.
Well, John says in the end of his gospel that that if you took all of the wonders that Jesus performed, you could fill the books of the world. It's hyperbole, but it does make a point that Jesus was working miracles all the time. But he says he's selected a few to put in his gospel to encourage our faith in Jesus. And this is the end of John chapter 20. In any event, it gives the impression that Jesus was working lots of miracles. So would we want to say, you know, Jesus, you did like 15 in a week. We're going to just have to quit calling this a miracle because, you know, you're just over your quota of like miracles. So now they're just going to have to be kind of pretty cool things. And if you do very many more, we're just going to have to call them ordinary. No, I don't think that makes any sense.
So what is the definition of a miracle?
I don't know. I mean, I got an idea.
Well,
yeah, I just offered some. Keener says that it's an act of God. I mean, that's a piece of it. But there are a lot of things in our lives that are acts of God, and one that was suggested in the question was conversion. But, you know, I don't think when we're discussing miracles, we want to include that in with our definition. We want to distinguish the kinds of attesting miracles that were done by Jesus and the prophets, etc., from something like the wonderful act of God called regeneration. And so, but philosophers have struggled with definitions for a long time, and that's part of the difficulty of miracles.
Would you say part of the definition of a miracle is going against the normal laws of
nature?
No,
that's one that's regularly taken exception with by philosophers, and that is, it's not like you're going contrary to the laws of nature, and what they'd want to say is that the laws of nature are just exempted here. They don't apply under these circumstances. Now, that might be mincing words for some people, but in these more refined conversations about this definition, there are reasons why they want to make that kind of distinction. That's a little beyond me right now, and that's why I can't recall all the particulars, but this is part of what I've read.
Okay. Next question. Is it wrong to be involved in creating a film with a pro-LGBT message?
Well, is LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender that is the pro, let's just call it the pro-homosexual message. Is homosexuality good or bad? This is our first question. And if as a Christian you are convinced, as I am, that homosexuality is an egregious wrong before God, Then how do we justify, and again, involve, that word involve was a little fudge word. It depends how involved one is, you know. How do we justify having a significant role in advancing a film that encourages people to do what God calls abominable? So I think the hard part there is, well, wait, maybe I'm just like a tech in Hollywood, and all I do is flip switches and turn lights on and focus, whatever, you know, and does that really count? And And this is where somebody's going to have to make their own decision. I think Hollywood's a tough business to be in because so much of the stuff that's produced is not just ungodly, but it's anti-God. And I have friends, as you do, Melinda, in the industry, and some of them have could be much, much higher up in the business than they are if they hadn't said no to a lot of things they said no to out of conscience. So, you know, I think in general, I think it's wrong to be significantly involved in an enterprise that promotes something that God says is wrong.
Some people we know in the entertainment industry, they've asked you your advice in the past about taking a role on mm-hmm. this or that. And in general, a general principle has been, even if the role you're playing is a bad, evil person, what is the general message of
Correct.
The program or whatever it is? You know, because if it's telling the truth overall, you could participate as that evil character if they're shown to be evil.
Sure. You
So a pro-LGBT message is not telling the truth.
That's correct. I mean, if you weren't careful about how you characterize this, then you wouldn't even be able to play a movie in the Bible. You wouldn't be able to play Judas,
right?
You know, because Judas was bad, you know. But the message, and that's the big thing, is the message being communicated here, does it characterize things in their accurate sense? I was a big fan very early on, a long time ago, when I was in high school, of Camelot. I loved that movie, but Camelot has a very big adultery theme in it, but it showed the destructiveness of adultery. Mm-hmm. And so I think there it told the truth about it. It didn't tell a lie about it, and that's the distinction you're talking about.
Okay, that's it for this week, folks. This little studio's getting hot and stuffy, so I'm going to get out of here and let you spend 2 more hours in
that's
here.
Right.
Just breathe in your own carbon dioxide. You can send us your questions on Twitter. Use hashtag STRAsk. We post 2 episodes every week, Mondays and Thursdays. I'm Melinda the Enforcer with Greg Kolkel for Stand to Reason.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.